Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. Oxford professor J.R.R. Tolkien began his exploration of Middle-earth with those words, and from the children's classic The Hobbit to the epic and very adult The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's adventurous tales of hobbits and elves, dwarves and wizards have mesmerized generations of readers. Since its publication in 1954, The Lord of the Rings consistently tops favorite book readers' polls. Morgan Library and Museum, located on Madison Avenue and 36th Street, is currently featuring a major exhibition called Tolkien, Maker of Middle-earth, which celebrates both the man and his creations. John McQuillan is the assistant curator for printed books and bindings at the Morgan, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Can you tell us a little bit about Tolkien's childhood? He was born in South Africa in 1892.
Indeed. Both of his parents were English, and they had moved down there for a better life. Tolkien's father worked for what was the Dutch Bank in South Africa, and he was born in 1892, and then a younger brother followed 2 years later.
We always look for clues to what happened later in childhood. Did South Africa play a role in what we what he came to write, or does everything really start with World War One?
It played a very indirect role. When Tolkien was 4 years old, his mother Mabel took his younger brother Hilary and Ronald back to England to visit family, and the father stayed in South Africa for work. He unfortunately never visited the family and died while they were away from rheumatic fever. So Mabel and the two boys then stayed in England. And Tolkien later in life was very clear in how kind of formative this move was for a four-year-old to go from the dry, arid, hot climate of South Africa and then land in the idyllic, pastoral English countryside, and that sort of the imprint of that verdant, green, lush landscape clearly impacted his future literary creations.
And then his mother died?
His mother passed away from diabetes when he was 12 years old, which in the early 20th century was still an untreatable disease. She had been a formative part of his education and taught him a love of language, literature, art, even in the few years that they really had together in this village outside of Birmingham where they lived. And also then the loss of her was another significant impact.
And why did his mother assign a Catholic priest as the guardian of Tolkien and his younger brother?
When Arthur Tolkien died, Mabel converted to Catholicism, partly in a way to find some solace in her grief. And the two boys, her family, her in-laws, very ardent Church of England, did not approve of this move and so disowned her, really, kind of in the family. So she turned to the Catholic Church for assistance.
And Father Morgan became his guardian. He interfered when Tolkien fell in love with a young woman named Edith Bratt. Well, why did he object?
He was very displeased that Tolkien had a distraction from his schoolwork and thought that he was spending too much time with Edith rather than concentrating on his studies, and so ended up forbidding Tolkien to speak or see Edith until he was 21 years old, which at that time was 3 years away for Tolkien.
And their romance has a kind of a fairy tale quality to it.
It was. He never fell out of love with Edith. And on the verge of his 21st birthday, he wrote a letter to her to reconnect. She was already engaged to someone else. But Tolkien persevered, the two reunited, and were married.
And remained married for a long time.
He was always very clear that she was the love of his life.
Then he went off to fight in World War I. What were his experiences like?
Immediately after graduating with his undergrad degree from Oxford, he joined the army and was sent to northern France to the Battle of the Somme. Hmm. And again, this very strong dislocation from Oxford, the love of his life, to war is also incredibly formative for his imagination and his life. And I think seeing, you know, the worst that man can do to man had a great impact on what he would later create.
And it had an important impact on British literature in general. Ford Madox Ford, a number of great poets all came out of World War I, changed men. In the case of Tolkien, many of his friends died in battle, but could it be argued that his serious illness, trench fever, may have saved his life?
Indeed. I think, thankfully for us, this illness did save him. He wasn't at the Battle of the Somme for too long before contracting this illness and being sent back to England.
What is trench fever?
It is a disease spread by body lice and involves fever, naturally high temperatures, body aches, hallucinations, really like an inability kind of to function.
Had he already been thinking about Middle Earth during the war?
He had. He had, in his teen years while in school, while in undergrad, had already sort of developed this, what he called a nonsense fairy language, a made-up, invented language that would later become Elvish. But at this time, it was just still a very newborn language, if you will. And he started to write poems and stories about the land in the West where the elves lived, this great history of elves, trying to put legends into the language, to have the language survive by or give life to the language that he created by creating these stories that go around them.
To what extent are the scenes of battles in The Lord of the Rings drawn from his memories of the trenches?
I think perhaps only tangentially. I don't know if there's a specific kind of biographical instance. He was always kind of clear that there were very few elements directly from his life that ended up in the stories. But I think he was a master at creating such vivid pictures of scenes and settings of battle. And he drew, of course, on his experience, but I don't think it was sort of some sort of like one-to-one correlation that the Battle of the Five Armies equals the Battle of the Somme.
Was he kind of an autodidact? You say he was inventing a language all by himself. The exhibit also has a fair amount of the artwork that he created. As far as I know, he never went to art school, and yet it's pretty impressive stuff.
It is. And young men of his generation, kind of art, some sort of artistic training was part and parcel of your daily life. I mean, radio was invented, but before television, it was part of the entertainment, really, that you would do. And so he never had formal artistic training and always disparaged what drawings he could do and never thought himself a very great artist. But he was fantastic at converting the images in his minds to the visual page.
Although he never wanted anybody else to become an illustrator of his work.
No, he was very unsure about what any other artist, no matter their talents, would do to the story.
So he got a job at the Oxford English Dictionary, a man fascinated by language. I guess we
yes.
shouldn't be surprised. He worked on words starting with the letter W.
It must be a fascinating place to work, to just start at WA and work your way through. I don't even know how you would even begin to do this.
So they had to have at least 26 people working on that dictionary. Some languages some letters like E could have taken a lifetime.
Yeah, E, S, T, those are going to be the rough ones. W might be a good saving grace.
Yeah, probably X would have been a really easy job. And he was also translating scholarly works?
His undergraduate degree and his background was in Old and Middle English literature and the language and literature of medieval and pre-medieval Northern Europe. So he knew Finnish, he knew Icelandic, Old German, Gothic, some kind of extinct Old European languages. And so in order to make ends meet, he was a newlywed. For his young family, he was taking on working on W, working on German.
And he then went on to teach Old English and Old Norse literature at Oxford for 30 years?
His first teaching job was actually at the University of Leeds for about 5 years. And then Oxford called, and he knew that was a university he wanted to get back to. But he was through a couple of positions. He spent the rest of his life and pretty much his adult professional life as a professor of English at Oxford.
Was he a popular professor?
I think it depends upon who you ask. He was well known in the Oxford community and held one of the highest university professor chairs. But there are also stories. He was not a very, in some ways, inspirational lecturer and professor. He mumbled and spoke quickly and sometimes softly with a pipe in his mouth. He was not the most gregarious presenter of information, even though he was absolutely brilliant at that information. So I don't know that he would grab undergrad audiences today like university lecturers do.
That's surprising to some degree because he was such a good storyteller. The best professors usually are good storytellers.
I think you have to be in order to grab people's attention. But I think his efforts really were more for the written page and the written word where his true genius comes out.
He and his wife, Edith, had 4 children. Did he discover his gift for storytelling by creating tales for the kids?
I'm sure that was one of the many ways that it came out for they were, for example, the first audience for The Hobbit. They were the story was for them, and they were not really that pleased that it was published for the world to read, but also
they thought it was done for them personally.
It was their story. Mm-hmm. And they were not too keen to have others let into their world, but also for 25 years, every Christmas, Tolkien wrote a letter as Father Christmas to his children, relating tales of Father Christmas's adventures at the North Pole, accompanying with drawings accompanying about his house, whatever adventures, his night rides into Oxford. But 25 years worth of letters. As the children got older, the stories got kind of more adventurous. In the 1930s, when he started working on The Hobbit, Father Christmas's helpers, who were called gnomes, became elves. Mm. Goblins came to the North Pole. So the world of Middle-earth starts encroaching on the North Pole.
I'm speaking with John McQuillan of the Morgan Library and Museum. There is a new exhibit there called Tolkien, Maker of Middle-earth, which is running through May 12th. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. So let's talk about Middle Earth. Is it located roughly where Europe is?
Yes, he was.
This is before Brexit, so
who knows where it will be now? It was Tolkien was very clear that Middle Earth is our current world. It wasn't some other planet or completely fantasy world. It was a very very much pre-modern European world.
A prehistoric. Not prehistoric in the way we usually mean prehistoric, but prehistory world.
Yes.
He once said, "I wisely started with a map and made the story fit." How did he create a sense of an actual world with seemingly real landmarks and a credible imaginary history?
That reference is to Lord of the Rings and the kind of famous Lord of the Rings map that he produced for that story. And he was always very intent to be sure that the world he was creating, you know, followed certain rules. It was unto itself a very real physical place. And so the narrative did not create the world, but the world created the narrative. And so characters do not travel more in a single day than they naturally physically could. There are weather patterns. There are cycles to the moon. It is a real place, and the geography really dictates in some ways what can happen in the story.
His main working map is an accumulation of sheets taped together. So the map evolved as the story developed?
It sort of grew and had to be redrawn and rewritten as parts. You know, naturally, the Lord of the Rings map he used for over 12 years while writing Lord of the Rings. So as you can imagine, it got very well used. It has frayed edges. It was like a car road atlas, folded and misfolded and refolded. It's taped together in places. There are burns from his pipe tobacco on it. And so it had to get, you know, the pencil faded and had to be redone in ink. Parts maybe got damaged, and he had to sort of have a little slip of paper redrawing the map, and then that pasted on. It's a well-loved and well-used document.
Well, he was carrying a heavy workload as a teacher, and then he was doing this. How attentive was he as a father and a husband?
I don't know anyone else who you know, has the ability and energy to do as many things as J.R.R. Tolkien did, because what I think a lot of people who are fans of the books or don't know is that he was not by trade an author. His day job was a professor in the English department at the University of Oxford. His family duties then came after his work life. And then at the corners of the evenings and weekends and holidays is when he could turn to Middle Earth.
And as you said, he started constructing Elvish when he was just a child. Didn't he spend decades inventing not just one language, but a whole family of languages? Are these languages, the Elvish tongues, is what they're called, related in any way that, let's say, the Romance languages are?
They follow a very similar pattern. Tolkien, in his professional life, was a philologist, and so a historian of language. And so he followed that same pattern and belief with the Elvish language, that there was a history to the development of the languages that he had created. There were relationships between dialects of Elvish, just as there are certain relationships between French and Spanish, Italian, all stemming from Latin, and particularly even with as an amalgam of languages as English is, with Latin, French, and German influences, that same kind of pattern he developed in these languages for Middle Earth.
But the languages that he seemed to draw upon are languages that don't come out of the Germanic or the Latin languages. Finnish, Welsh?
He thought he was absolutely fascinated from an early age by the look of Welsh. And when you see Welsh and actually hear it spoken, it is both visually and orally stunning. And
driving in Wales is interesting, because you see that you're entering some town and you have no idea how to pronounce it.
But it was a language, and Finnish as well, that he just thought were so beautiful to both look at and hear, that particularly for Finnish, it had a strong impact on what was his made-up fairy language that then became one of the Elvish dialects.
Finnish and Hungarian are related languages through some strange reason, but unlike any other European languages?
They are a little bit all related in the greater sort of Indo-European language family, but not, I don't want to say sort of outliers or fringe, but not as sort of largely impactful as sort of Latin and Greek had become for Western Europe.
Are many Elvish words used in the books? Did he worry that they might serve as an impediment for readers?
No, I think there are a lot of Elvish phrases, songs that he used, particularly in Lord of the Rings and some in the Silmarillion. But I think he had this absolute trust in both his reader and the text, and that the reader would understand from the text what was being said. There are translations of the Elvish in the stories, in the published volumes. But I think he also firmly believed that, like, readers would understand what he was saying.
Well, obviously, it didn't hurt the popularity of the books over the years. But both the physical topography and the Elvish language were created first, and then Tolkien wrote the story?
He began, the Elvish language came first, and so then what we know now as the Silmarillion, the history of the elves, was his life's work, really. It was never published in his lifetime, though.
But he was working on it simultaneously while he was doing other things?
That was, yeah. He kind of began the stories related to the history of the elves in the 19-teens. He had the first idea about this sort of this other world of elves in about 1910. And so The Hobbit came out in 37, Lord of the Rings in the early 50s. And he continued working on this greater history of the elves for his entire life.
Many writers write notes and draw upon them when they're working on the novel or whatever. But do we know if any other author worked the way he worked?
Tolkien is unique among fantasy authors and I think fiction authors in terms of his world building. No other fantasy author that I know of is so complete in his creation of languages, geographies, histories, and that comes through really in the complete veracity of the stories.
Tolkien is frequently linked with the author C.S. Lewis. How did they become friends?
They met in Oxford. They were both members of a literary society called the Inklings, an informal group of Oxford students and dons that gathered together to discuss kind of work in progress or ideas for works, hence the title Inklings, like you have an inkling of an idea. This developed into a little bit of a more formal group with other literary figures, authors, men who were interested sort of in myth creation and the importance of mythologies and, for Tolkien's purposes, fairy stories, for the importance of those to revealing sort of incarnate human truths. And the two developed, at first, neither of them liked each other. And I think Lewis made some comment about Tolkien really, you know, could use two swift slaps.
Tolkien object to Lewis's obvious use of Christian allegory?
Eventually, this it sort of developed over the couple of decades the two were in Oxford together. And it was really towards the end of their relationship when Lewis had sort of fully reconverted to Church of England and a very ardent Church of England, that there was developed a sort of rift between them because Tolkien didn't really appreciate his kind of devotion. And he did not at all approve of Lewis's overt references to Christianity in the Narnia Chronicles.
Yet we have this odd situation where we have these two writers who become very popular who share an interest in myth and fantasy. Mm-hmm. Were any of the other Inkling members also involved with this, or were they more likely to have been writing realistic stories and novels.
No, the other members were all kind of related to, had some, I mean, what now we would call like fantasy writers, poetry influences from Nordic myth and legend and poetry. And so it was sort of this interest in that sort of pre-medieval European history that inspired, to some extent, all of them.
And did they offer encouragement, or did they critique each other's work?
Both. These inkling meetings, individuals would read selections of what they had just written or pass them around, and the other members would both congratulate and criticize. For Lewis and Tolkien, this came in very severe back and forths, with great congratulations from Lewis to Tolkien on The Lay of Lúthien, an early tale about elves that Tolkien submitted. But then 2 days later, pages and pages of criticism from Lewis that Tolkien fully appreciated. He was glad he had found someone, a fellow in this realm, who both understood his work and could both appreciate but also have positive criticism for him.
Well, it's always important to get that kind of feedback, either from an editor or, in this case, somebody who you might consider an equal, even though they were obviously, they saw each other as rivals as well. So it was an uneasy friendship. How long did the did their friendship last? And how long did the group, the Inklings, last?
So it began in the late 1920s, about 1930, just for an easy timeline. And by about the early 50s is when Lewis had ended up with a job at Cambridge University and would be back in Oxford only on the weekends. And so geography sort of helped the group fall apart. The rift between Lewis and Tolkien over their faith also spurned this. But then Lewis started dating an American divorcee. And that, for Tolkien, was sort of really one of the final death knell on the relationship.
Did he talk to Lewis about Lewis's best-known work, The Chronicle of Narnia?
He did. Tolkien had severe criticism for it because he did not think Lewis had done enough in terms of world-building to create Narnia as a world unto itself, as the way he had with Middle-earth. And he also did not appreciate...
Lewis should have done maps and drawings.
It would have helped. They should have had their own language. And he thought the talking animals, the witches, there was too much going on. There were too many strands being tried to pull together.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on John McQuillan, who is the assistant curator for printed books and bindings at the Morgan Library and Museum. Do you have to write that out every time you do a job description?
Absolutely. I'm glad to have the book binding title on there. It's something a little bit different.
The exhibit that's currently at the Morgan, Tolkien, Maker of Middle-earth, runs through May 12th. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like a typical exhibit for the Morgan.
Well, for a fantasy author, no. But for the material we do related to the creation of authorial process, an artistic process, it's very much part and parcel of what we do. We've had exhibitions on the story of the creation of The Little Prince by Antoine Saint-Exupéry. Mm-hmm. We have upcoming Maurice Sendak show. Even Beatrix Potter. So this sort of like relationship of an author to both the visual and textual creation of the world is something that we really enjoy.
In this case, you not only have manuscripts, but you also have artwork and maps. Were they easy to get on loan?
Surprisingly, yes. The exhibition actually was created at the Bodleian Library at the University of Oxford. They hold the Tolkien archive, most of his personal papers, illustrations, family items. It's over 500 boxes of manuscript material in over 300 volumes from his personal library.
Wow.
The Tolkien archivist, Catherine McElwain, wrote the catalog and originally curated the show. So what we have at the Morgan is a version of the exhibition that was in Oxford this past summer. It's also interesting that the manuscripts for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings are not in Oxford, but actually reside at Marquette University Library in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Tolkien sold those to Marquette in the late 50s for £1,500.
Not much.
Not much, but what at the time
the pound was
he
strong.
Thought more than they were worth. That was a large sum for him, he thought, and that was just before Lord of the Rings really hit it big.
When did he publish The Hobbit, or actually the full title is The Hobbit, or There and Back Again?
Yes.
An odd title.
Just so you know, there will be a happy ending. You get to go and come back. He originally wrote it for his children, kind of, 1929 to 33-ish, and told it to them over Christmas breaks over those several years. It was published as a printed book in September of 1937 in England.
Intended for children? Because I was wondering if you want to really know about Tolkien as an adult, should you start by reading it as well?
I think he never really liked the idea of it as a children's book. It is for young readers. It is geared to them, but you still need to have a certain reading ability to get at it. But it was a pretty, for a surprise to both the publisher and Tolkien, a critical and popular success right off the bat.
How would you describe the Hobbit's way of life and behavior? Because it's different from humans.
It is. They are very kind of set in their ways and comfortable. They like the greater, as many of us do, the greater comforts of home, of food, of drink.
So is this autobiographical on some level?
I think that's what everyone sort of aspires to, is to be a hobbit and have 11 Z's and second breakfast. And so it's this very comfortable lifestyle that then the hobbit gets jarred out of.
Is the land where the hobbits live, called the Shire, patterned after the English countryside?
Yes, it's one of the few very specific sort of biographical instances in all the stories from Middle Earth that Tolkien was clear on, is that, the Shire really is the village outside of Birmingham where he grew up after returning to England.
Now, after he wrote, they had fairly successful sales initially for The Hobbit. Did his publishers want more stories?
They did. They were very excited to have a sequel to The Hobbit, more of Bilbo's adventures.
But they didn't want to publish the Silmarillion?
Silmarillion.
Silmarillion?
No, it's a – even now, the Silmarillion is a very, very large epic tome that's almost biblical in scope and covers thousands of years of history. It really is almost more of a history book than a literary narrative. And it was – they really were not sure about something so large in the years – between the two world wars, and even after World War II, it still was not anything they were too very certain about.
But it took him 12 years to write The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
Did he revise a lot?
He did revise a lot, but what initially was supposed to be Bilbo's adventures and a book called The Magic Ring, as he started working on that, he knew this was not working, and it grew into Lord of the Rings and became sort of more epic, more adult for readership. And between his children growing up and going to college, over this time, World War II begins and ends. He had his academic duties, family duties, wartime air raid duties in Oxford. It really sort of delayed the full creation of Lord of the Rings.
But he completed it in 1949. It wasn't published until 1955.
It took. It started in 54 with The Fellowship of the Ring, is when the first volume came out.
Did he conceive of it as one long book that got wound up being published in three volumes?
Yes. It for him was one continuous narrative, not three parts or three volumes. And it took a great deal of convincing from his publisher to see that it had to be broken up just for financial reasons. In the years in England after World War II, a massive book that the entire work would have been just was not financially feasible.
He invented a number of languages, but he also, in addition to the hobbits, created a number of different races to populate mm-hmm. Middle Earth: elves, dwarves, orcs, wizards. And each race has a distinctive characteristic and traits. Why did he use that device?
Some of them are drawn directly out of a lot of the Norse sagas and poetic epics. The elves and dwarves come straight out of Norse literature. But that he kind of weaves them into his greater history of the elves in the Silmarillion, and then they come back out again then in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings.
And then there are humans, such as Aragorn.
There are mortals. It's sort of part of his greater mythology of Middle Earth that there are these races. Ultimately, we come down to today where it's just the mortals that survive. But that there were these races and different groups created. And what comes out in Lord of the Rings is a way that these different groups do and do not get along, whether by choice, many times by choice. And so I know that a lot of current undergrad and graduate courses sort of talk about social diversity and race and gender in Lord of the Rings because of this issue of different races, and what does that mean?
Some have criticized the Lord of the Rings for having characters that are one-dimensional. They're either good or evil. Is that a fair criticism?
From my experience, kind of only for the orcs. The orcs are created as bad creatures that live to serve Sauron or Saruman as warriors and killers. All the other characters, even the ones that are supposedly all good, like the elves or the hobbits, they do make right and wrong decisions, good and bad. There is not a single group really that is, you know, pristine. Everyone makes choices, and there are responsibilities for those choices, and that's what you really see the different groups and individuals in the Lord of the Rings come to terms with, is their choices.
Is Frodo Baggins the main protagonist of the Lord of the Rings? Some have suggested that he's one of the great heroes of English literature. Is he a hobbit?
He is. He is Bilbo's nephew he's the nephew of the hobbit. And so he is clearly a central figure in Lord of the Rings and one of the main characters that moves the narrative forward. But there are a number of individuals, whether hobbit, elf, dwarf, and mortal, who do similar.
When he returns to the Shire at the end of his quest, would you consider him a conquering hero or more of a shell-shocked veteran? Because this is after World War II, and England was seeing an awful lot of shell-shocked veterans. And, of course, there was a lot of shell shock in World War I as well.
It's surprising how close those two things actually can be. And for both at the end of The Hobbit and at the end of The Lord of the Rings, you have this sort of narrative that ultimately talks about dealing with loss and the loss of home or loss of what you thought home was. And when this journey there and back again, You go somewhere, you change and develop, you grow, you come back. Home is going to be different because you're different. And so we learn at the end of Lord of the Rings that Frodo and Bilbo really can't go home again. And yet others, like Sam Gamgee, have grown, but grown to appreciate their home and love their home. And so he is able ultimately then to stay.
What role did his son, Christopher Tolkien, play in creating the books that we now know?
I think a critical role. Not only was he one of the original audiences for The Hobbit, sitting in his father's study on Christmas breaks listening to the tale, but he helped his father draw the maps that were used in the first edition of The Hobbit. He helped him with aspects of Lord of the Rings, similarly with like working on actual production material. And since Tolkien's death in 1973, Christopher has been really his literary executor and the one who has continued his father's work in not the same way of creating Middle Earth, but helping to get his father's material published, and particularly the Silmarillion, which was a mass of incomplete stories and versions upon versions of stories, worked to edit that together into a little bit more of a coherent narrative. So for me, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien is really the maker of Middle Earth, but Christopher is an incredibly close second.
Interestingly, Tolkien is published almost as prolifically posthumously as when he was alive.
Yeah.
But how have his works been assessed by other writers and critics? I know Edmund Wilson, among others, dismissed the series as juvenile trash, but W.H. Auden, reviewing it in the New York Times, called it a masterpiece.
When it first came out, C.S. Lewis praised it as lightning from a clear sky. It's that sort of a shocking revelation to read this work. I think you have to understand what Tolkien was trying to achieve with it. And it's a very different type of fantasy work than your typical fantasy or sci-fi creation. It is more of a complete world building. And so to judge it, I think you come up short if you try and judge it based on sort of just your run-of-the-mill sci-fi work.
Well, it doesn't seem to fit in with the other people we think of as the greats of 20th century literature, Joyce, Wolfe, Faulkner, the like. But they were always popular. Lord of the Rings was always popular despite its length and ambition. And when the mass market paperback edition was released in the United States in 1965, didn't the books find a whole new audience?
It really re-inspired America in the mid-60s and the hippie generation, people who were looking for a sort of return to questions about living with nature and the divine and faith, and how these sort of play a role and come to play a role in Lord of the Rings. And it was really in the 60s when, you know, the Tolkien popularity really took off. It had sold well, but it wasn't until about, 1968-69, right after Tolkien sold the manuscripts to Marquette, that he started getting larger and larger royalty checks.
And people started wearing Frodo Lives buttons. Yeah. But, okay, the royalty checks. He agreed to no advances or royalties until the books broke even, and then he got a larger share of the profits. So was that a good deal for him?
The family struggled financially through their entire life. He had to take on more and more sort of teaching academic duties to survive. And so at face value, it doesn't quite look like that was the smartest thing for him to do. But looking back on it, the last, decade or so of his life, he and his wife were finally able to really have a very comfortable and worry-free retirement.
I mentioned that that his artwork is a lot more impressive than one might expect from somebody who got little or no training, and it's surprisingly varied. So he constantly experimented with different styles and media.
from an early age, he had a certain aptitude for particularly landscape illustration, again, stemming mm-hmm. from his love of the English countryside. And he really excels at landscape painting.
Did he assume that they would be published with the books?
For The Hobbit, the American edition requested, in 1938, requested watercolor illustrations. And so he produced 5 illustrations that are now very famous. And we have in the exhibition at the Morgan. And they show like absolutely beautiful landscapes. He had a real flair for depicting kind of light and atmosphere. And so his abilities, he was not afraid at all to work with color or inspiration from different, he has certain illustrations that show a clear influence from Art Nouveau, others from Asian styles. He was not at all adverse to sort of experimenting with style or color in ways to depict his creation and the aspects of Middle Earth.
He resisted people interpreting things, reading things into his books. He always claimed that The Lord of the Rings wasn't an allegory about the atomic bomb or World War II. Mm-hmm. He also dismissed critics who compared his books to the Wagner Ring Cycle operas, even though the word ring appears there.
That, which is funny because The Lord of the Rings, which is originally called The Magic Ring, which sounds very mm-hmm. Nibelung-like and maybe sort of inspired the turn away from that. But for him, I mean, much like the Nibelung, allegories for the atomic age or modern society, Tolkien was working in such large-scale cultural ideas that there are going to be ways you can see current wars, current political climate, current ethnic issues in his works. Well, and I think that's important. It's not an allegory of a single instance. They are issues that are so important and so broad that it really, you can see reflections of so many aspects of our life in the stories.
Wagner's work often reflected his politics. What about Tolkien?
I feel like he strove to really keep specific politics out of it. He has his very much clear ideas on sort of a little bit of the evils of the modern world and turning back to things that are handmade, individual, personal, the sort of large-scale industrialization he was never keen on. But I don't think there's a direct parallel with sort of Saruman and Sauron, and many look to Hitler and certain people. And again, I think these are these large scale cultural motifs that find their way into Lord of the Rings that it's easy to see in our current society.
Do you think the popularity of Lord of the Rings has influenced the popularity of other series like Harry Potter series or Star Wars?
I think they are all very much related, and I think there's a reason that the Game of Thrones author is George R.R. Martin, much like J.R.R. Tolkien. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a nice parallel there, and in their sort of like their little bit alternate world creation, they are very the audiences for, particularly with Rowling and Tolkien, I think are so divergent. Their purposes, their audiences are so different. They're related in terms of sort of fantasy literature, and they're in the same section at Barnes & Noble. But I think when you look at their authorial intent, the works are really quite different.
Record-breaking crowds are being predicted to this exhibition at the Morgan Library and Museum. What's the best time for a visitor to try to see it?
It's anytime you would like to come. I would love to see you there. We are open Tuesday through Sunday.
Won't be as crowded on a snowy day.
Yeah, exactly. Today is a little bit light. If you can slide your way down Madison Avenue, then you are welcome. You're welcome to wear a costume. You're welcome.
But you have to wear shoes.
You need to wear shoes, no hobbit feet. And we have umbrella, coat, and sword check in the museum. So we are prepared.
John McQuillan is the assistant curator for printed books and bindings at the Morgan Library and Museum, which is currently, first of all, it's on Madison Avenue and 36th Street, and currently showing Tolkien, Maker of Middle Earth. It's running through May 12th. People can check it out on www.themorgan.org. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to John McQuillan, to Deborah Freeman, who produced this segment, to my producer, Jesse Lent, who was at the audio controls, and to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music.
Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.